makes you good on TV has nothing, zero, zilch to do with whether or not you had a Hall of Fame jacket or made a Pro Bowl or intercepted a pass on primetime. It doesn't have anything to do with it. People, that may get people to look at you initially, but it for darn sure does not hold their attention. And I think you are seeing that more and more. People want quality on TV, regardless of who you were before, and they will quickly tune you out if you aren't bringing it on TV to the point where you're going to hold their attention. Jerry used to say this to me. Your job is to inform, educate, and entertain. All three of those. Inform, educate, and entertain. Not just entertain, not just inform, not just educate. If you can get all three of them and you can get it going naturally, that's who the people are going to watch. Oh, and that's what I always keep in mind every time I go on TV.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Alan Kim. And this week, our guest is the ESPN NFL front office insider, Louis Riddick. Louis, if you read my column, you know I think this guy is fantastic. And I've thought so since he's been on the air. He is now part of ESPN's draft coverage for all 3 days. He will be in one of those big chairs for rounds one through round seven, which is terrific and I think an excellent move by ESPN. And so he'll be both with the Berman Group and then with the Trey Wingo Group. And that's going to be excellent for their coverage. You also see him on various NFL studio shows. And again, he's I think he's really added a lot to their coverage. And that's Seth Markman is the guy who's in charge of NFL studio shows there. And that is absolutely one of his better hires, in my opinion. So I've been looking forward to having a conversation with Louis about his unique background and sort of just what how he has morphed from a NFL front office person to a media person. And he's not a guy who had a big name. This is not Ray Lewis coming in. It's a guy who played 6 or 7 years in the NFL, and most 25, 30-year-old fans would have no idea of his NFL career. And that's interesting, too, and I'll ask him about whether people who are not stars, NFL stars, coming into places like ESPN or Fox, is there biased against them from the jump? Because it's just harder for them to get jobs than if you're a name person like a Ray Lewis or Dan Marino, et cetera. So Louis Riddick will be the guest. I'm looking forward to having that conversation. He'll join us very briefly. Thanks again for all your support of previous podcasts. The Ken Burns numbers were fantastic, as were the NBA stuff with Hubie Brown and Zach Lowe. Those numbers were really good. Upcoming guest will be Jessica Mendoza of ESPN, and then hopefully we'll have some good guests come May. Okay, and as promised, let's bring in Louis Riddick, the ESPN NFL analyst. As I said at the top, you will be seeing him, as you did last year, on ESPN's NFL draft coverage. He was terrific, and that's an excellent move by their management to bring him back. Louis, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks a lot, Richard. Been looking forward to this for a long time. Thank you.
You got it. I want to start with this. There are a lot of NFL analysts at ESPN, and depending on how you classify them, you know, that number could be, that's in the dozens and dozens, from your traditional analysts who are former players or coaches to even information people who sometimes work as analysts. So when you are working, Louis, at a place that has literally dozens and dozens of people who fall under this tag, how do you stand out in such a crowded environment? What is your thought process in terms of how can my content be different than my fellow colleagues?
Well, I think number one is that my experiences are much more different, or much different and much more recent than most any, if not all, of the analysts there in this respect. I have pretty much done it all at the NFL level in terms of playing, scouting, being on the headset during game days, being involved with the draft, being involved with free agency. So I have a very global, big picture perspective of the game that encompasses a lot, and it encompasses a lot recently. And when you then top it off with the fact that I've really been exposed to two of the greatest football minds really ever, in my estimation, at the pro level, that being with Bill Belichick and Nick Saban together back in Cleveland in the early 1990s, you know, there's really not too much that I have not been able to experience and or get taught about the game of football. And I use all those different experiences, all that different background kind of helps me formulate the kind of thoughts that I really try to put on TV when I do get on TV. And I've always been one who's been very comfortable as far as being able to express the kind of things that I've been taught, the kind of things that I've seen, the kind of things I've experienced. I've always been comfortable doing so. So it just kind of all comes together naturally. I just think my background, again, the people that I've been around, my natural just comfort with being able to talk about the game, a game that I've been around since I was 6, 7, 8 years old, being around professional football. It just all kind of comes together naturally. It's not really one thing that separates me. I just think it's my entire upbringing in this game and the people I've been fortunate enough to be exposed to.
Lewis, you are not so far removed from an NFL front office. 2013 is the last time you were employed by an NFL team. So we're only talking 3 years in broadcasting at this point. How did Seth Markman, who is your boss, ultimately find you or come to you about an ESPN opportunity?
Interesting. I'll tell you what, I had just left Philadelphia. Was trying to think of some places that I wanted to work in the NFL. Nothing was really panning out that summer. A cousin of mine named Will Lewis, who was the director of pro personnel for the Kansas City Chiefs, had heard that ESPN was going to be starting up a new TV show, a new NFL TV show called NFL Insiders. He had contacts with guys like John Clayton at ESPN, who had kind of told him about this new show. My cousin at the time was getting ready to, he was weighing the option of maybe trying to explore this new show or go and work for the Kansas City Chiefs in their front office. He decided to go work for the Chiefs. And when I was talking to him about what I was going to do front office wise, he said, look, I know you've always been interested in TV. There's some things going on up at ESPN. I'm going to kind of direct you to the right people here and see if that's something you want to look into. I had about a 30-minute conversation with Seth Markman then after we got hooked together, went up to Bristol. I believe it was in July of 2013, maybe August 2013, around there. And they had some rehearsals with a bunch of other people who were up there. That went really well. I got put on the show. Within about 2 months after that, 3 months after that, I was signed to a contract. It kind of went that fast, bing, bang, boom. It was one of those situations where being in the right place at the right time, having a relative who kind of knew what was going on up there, knew that I would probably be a good fit for that. And it just worked out. And I was very fortunate.
Lewis, when you initially were up there, when you sort of, for lack of a better phrase, let's call it a triad or something like that, that seems to be, that's kind of a leap of faith, it feels like, because, you don't have to obviously reveal the specific dollar amounts, but this could not have been a lucrative financial windfall for you prior to getting a real contract.
No, not at all. It wasn't at all. It was just something that I knew, to be honest with you, Richard, I knew once I got up there and once I was able to kind of put on camera my experiences, my knowledge, the kind of things that I knew about the game. I knew that they would be unique. I knew they would be something that they hadn't seen before, something that they didn't have on their roster. I knew I would be able to talk about it fluently. I knew I would be able to kind of get people to buy into what I was saying and hold their attention. And I had nothing but confidence in the fact that once I was able to do that and get enough shows under my belt that I would be able to parlay that into something much more long term. And I know that is a big leap of faith. I know that sounds easy to say after the fact, but that's the truth. That's just the way it happened. And things moved very quickly. I was very quickly able to establish some credibility up there with what I was putting on camera and what my process was like as far as preparing to go on the TV. Guys like Jerry Madelon did a great job of trying to coach me up and get me more comfortable on TV and teach me some of the nuance involved with keeping people engaged while they were watching. And I took it very seriously. This was not something that I kind of looked at it as, hey, well, this is just a natural transition for people who worked in front office who have been ex-players. I can just come on here and just start, you know, talking about football just the same as I would be talking about it in a bar or in my living room and expect people to really buy in. I took it very serious. I've always taken everything serious that way. And it paid off. It paid off. But I'm not, and I don't want this to come off the wrong way, but I'm not shocked that it happened that way. I had the utmost confidence that it would happen if I got that opportunity. Now, the only thing that I am shocked about is that my TV career started when it did. I wasn't expecting it to. I really didn't want it to. I still wanted to look at different things as far as scouting were concerned, but they weren't working out the way I wanted them to. And this has been a blessing in disguise. I'm actually, it's the best thing that's happened to me as far from a career perspective at that standpoint that could have happened to me, to be honest with you.
Do you now consider yourself a television person, or is the possibility of returning to your role as an NFL management person, is that still in the back of your mind?
Oh, there's all, I definitely consider myself a television person per se, because ESPN afforded me a great opportunity. They made a nice investment in me, and they've shown a lot of confidence in me, and I give them 100% of my effort and my attention. Now, that being said, if an opportunity came up to go back to the NFL and work with the right people, and the right people is critical at the right organization, they know that I'd be interested in doing that. And they know that I would, if that kind of situation came up, I'd think long and hard about it, because there's still some challenges, some things there that I haven't been able to do. But this has never been one of those deals where ESPN or TV was just a stopover, a bridge, another launching point to try and get back to the NFL. I never approached it that way. I'm not trying to use them that way. And I think it comes off. You can tell when people are doing media in order to kind of just set themselves up for their next gig. I pull no punches. I spare nobody. I don't take unnecessary shots. Everything I say is the truth, and everything I say is well-researched and well thought out, but I don't try and protect anyone. So you can tell I'm not trying to use ESPN as a springboard back to the NFL. If I go back to the NFL, it'll be because I'm with the right people and the people who respect what I'm saying right now and aren't really trying to play that, hey, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours game. I'm not really into that.
Yeah, I want to get to that, because that's interesting. And I agree that you have not come off on television as that, which as a viewer, I appreciate. You mentioned Jerry Madelon before. That's he was a well-known person at ESPN who helped talent get more comfortable on the air, particular talent that is new to the business. He's now he now works elsewhere in that same capacity. And so, Lewis, as someone who, again, is relatively new to the medium and was certainly new in 2013, in terms of the mechanics of being on television, what did you find was the most challenging for you? Because there is a craft to this. There's a craft to how you sit. There's a craft to how you speak. There's a craft to getting your point in a finite amount of time. So in terms of the mechanics of television, what did you find that was the thing that you needed to really tackle and try to perfect the most?
I think the number one thing was trying to make sure I was being as concise as I needed to be when talking about certain aspects of the game, whether it be on the football field or in the front office, and not getting too wordy, because there's so much information that I have. There's so many different experiences that I've had that one simple question I could go on and talk about for 15, 20 minutes. I could take up half of a show if I wanted to, just on one specific topic about like how to scout defensive back. And I think one of the challenge for me was to try and make sure I took the most important parts of whatever the specific topic was and making sure I really pared it down, took the most important parts of that topic and got them on TV so people could understand them very quickly and digest it very quickly. I tended to get too wordy, for lack of a better phrase. And Jerry helped me tremendously with making sure that I got to the message, answered questions right off the bat, and really gave him the information right away, and it didn't become something where I was getting too technical or going on too long. That was really the toughest thing for me, because coming from where I came from, you know, I sat in draft meetings and free agent meetings and had scouting meetings where We would sit in those kind of meetings from 7 in the morning until 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night. So you had a lot of time to really get in depth on certain things and I remember sitting in draft meetings talking about certain players in the first round where we would talk about the same guy for 3 hours. So, you know, it's hard for me to kind of pare down certain things into 45 seconds or a minute, however long you have, when I have so many different things running through my head about a certain topic. As far as the mechanics of, you know, having someone talk in my ear, what camera to look at, you know, how to sit, those kind of things, honestly, Richard, came kind of naturally to me. That stuff never bothered me. I never felt overwhelmed by getting direction in my ear or having people count down to a commercial in my ear or telling me camera one or camera two or, you know, knowing that they were going to come out to a full set picture. Those kind of things, that kind of flowed pretty easy for me. It was just making sure I didn't kind of like hog the whole darn show and just get too mouthy.
Lewis, you, am I correct? Did you play in the NFL for seven? Was it 7 years, 8 years?
6 years.
Okay. Six. You played in the NFL for 6 years and, you know, you played for a well-known college in high school, you know, and doing a little bit of research on you. Obviously, you were like an all-state standout. But You are not someone who came into broadcasting with, let's say, the resume of Peyton Manning, Ray Lewis, Tom Brady. This is a long preamble to ask you, have you, and this doesn't necessarily impact you because I think you've had tremendous success in broadcasting. But when you look at this stepping back, do you think there's a bias against the sort of average NFL player or let's say the non-quarterback versus people who have this great resume? They may not turn out to be good broadcasters, but they get that opportunity because they are or have been named players in the NFL.
Absolutely. There's absolutely a bias towards a predisposition to think that those players will make the best announcers, the best analysts, and will draw the most eyeballs, will grab people's attention. For sure, you see it happen all the time. And I take great pride in the fact that I've had the success I've had up to this point, and I didn't come into broadcasting with a Hall of Fame jacket or a bunch of Pro Bowls or a bunch of Super Bowls or a bunch of commercials and all of that. I take great pride in that, Richard, and I'm hoping that there's more people, more guys in the NFL who hopefully, I'll admit I was lucky to get the break that I did. Right place, right time, no question, but that's life. That's life for most people. But I took the ball and ran with it when I got it. And I think one thing that I'm showing is I think, and I'm hoping, and I'm hoping to put this on display again here in another week and a half, is that what your background was may get you opportunities as far as being on the main sets of the draft or primetime NFL coverage, whether it be in a studio, on location, or in a booth. It may get you that opportunity. But if we're darn sure is not a precursor and or a predictor of success as far as how you're going to be once you start talking and once you start opening your mouth and having to talk about the different things you're going to have to talk about. That has been proven too. And I'm hoping to keep pushing that envelope more and more and more and making it seem like and making people say, damn, where did this guy come from? Because I'd never heard of him, but I want to listen to that guy. And it's a little bit of a, now after the fact, it's a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. And it's something that kind of continues to motivate me because nobody, and I mean nobody, knew me when I started on TV. People, I remember looking on Twitter, and sometimes I see it now, like, who is this guy? Where did this guy come from? Because he doesn't have a Hall of Fame jacket. I never saw him on TV. I never saw him winning any Super Bowls, no MVPs, none of this and that. And you know, and I go, yep, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I don't care where guys come from. And I respect all the great players in the NFL. Trust me. I respect them all. I respect the game. The game is who I've always identified myself with since I was a kid. The game has done a lot of great things for my family. And look, all that. But the media and what makes you good on TV has nothing, zero, zilch to do with whether or not you had a Hall of Fame jacket or made a Pro Bowl or intercepted a pass on primetime. It doesn't have anything to do with it. People, that may get people to look at you initially, but it for darn sure does not hold their attention. And I think you are seeing that more and more. People want quality on TV, regardless of who you were before. And they will quickly tune you out if you aren't bringing it on TV to the point where you're going to hold their attention. Jerry used to say this to me. Your job is to inform, educate, and entertain. All three of those. Inform, educate, and entertain. Not just entertain, not just inform, not just educate. If you can get all three of them and you can get it going naturally, that's who the people are going to watch. Oh, and that's what I always keep in mind every time I go on TV.
One of the things you mentioned before, which is always interesting to me, is about you giving your honest, unfiltered opinions. And this is not just pertaining to you, but pertaining to a lot of people who work in sports broadcasting, without thinking down the road as to how this opinion may or may not impact me getting another job. So that leads to the question, Lewis, of so often as a viewer, it's not that I'm frustrated sometimes with what people say. I sometimes, and maybe this is sort of the part of the cynic in me, I wonder what I'm not being told because of allegiances and alliances that broadcasters still have with their former teams, with people who are in the league. So for you, again, and I appreciate your candidness that, like, if the right offer came along, you would certainly listen to it. So how do you weigh being candid, being honest with the viewer, which is, in my opinion, your primary job, versus knowing that if you say something, you may potentially upset a future employer, an owner of a team? How do you weigh all that? Because I do think, honestly, there are people in the medium whose alliances are not to me as a viewer first, to be quite honest.
Well, the way I look at it really is like this. Number one, I never lie. I never make up stuff. I never try to fill in gaps. So no one can ever accuse me of speculating and or trying to just get people to tune in or get people to click on my Twitter feed or anything like that. That's number one. And I've gotten that directly back from people who work in the league who are still good friends of mine, who I have said things about that don't cast them in the best light, but they respect me because they know, one, I've walked it, I've lived it, I've been in those, I've done everything that they've done, and they know I come from a place of credibility. So I think that leads into my next thing. Number two, people know that I'm credible. They know that I've been in those locker rooms, I've been in those draft meetings, I've been in those free agent meetings, I've been in scouting meetings, I've been on the headset in a booth on a regular game, and I've been coached by some of the best. So they respect my knowledge, they respect my cred. And I think that allows me to go maybe a little bit further with some of the things that I say, both in terms of praise and criticism, than some other people do, because they just don't have the same background that I do. And it doesn't always make people comfortable. They may not always like it, but they respect it. And that's all that I really care about. I don't ever take shots that are unwarranted. I don't ever try to personally attack people. But I do tell it the way I see it, and I tell it based off of what I've seen in the past and what I've experienced. And if that pisses some people off and they don't want to, and then they look at me as going, well, who the heck is that guy think he is? I would never hire him, man. I would never bring him in here, you know, because he's one of those types of guys who thinks he can just say what he wants to say. Well, then so be it. Because quite honestly, those same people weren't beating down my door when I got the opportunity at ESPN to hire me then. So I don't really feel like I need to protect them now. I don't think I really need to somehow play that game of, oh, the almighty NFL, I better not say too many things about this team or that team because therefore I may not ever get a job again. But I understand why some people would be interested in talking to me now. But see, I kind of carry that chip on my shoulder about, well, hey, you know what? You weren't really that interested in talking to me before. So I'm not going to really protect you now. But I'm not going to try and cheap shot you. I'm not going to take shots at you. There are people in the league, I'd be lying if I didn't say that there aren't people in the league who I'm very close to that they know that there are things that I will say about them that don't always cast them in the best of light, but I'm being honest about it. But there's also information that, but quite honestly, I don't know if it needs to be disseminated on a large scale, like maybe some people would want, out of respect for them. But I don't think you ever get the feeling that I am trying to tiptoe around subjects and or trying to not inform, educate the viewer to the point where it seems like I'm trying to protect my interest in the future. I don't ever think about that really when I'm on TV. I tell it like it is. I know this, Richard. I know there are plenty of people. There are plenty of teams that wouldn't hire me based on some of the things that I've said or how strong my personality is. It's probably one of the main reasons why I'm not in the NFL right now, because I have a strong personality. I believe what I believe in football. I'm very confident in what I believe. And then at the same time, I've made new friends in the NFL right now. And I know there are a couple of people right now, if they went back to the league, I know I could go work for if they were to get in positions where themselves and me could hook up, because of how strong my opinion has been on TV. It's worked both ways. Hmm. It's worked against me. It's worked for me. And that's the way of the world. You can't please everybody. And I don't really care about pleasing everybody.
Lewis, you will be on the main set for ESPN for 3 days of the draft this year. So both for the round one night, primetime night, and then rounds one and three, and then rounds four through seven. You were on the set last year, where you made your television debut. I think a lot of people probably don't know that you were on ESPN Radio before preparing for the draft. So the draft was not necessarily a new thing to you. But now this is a big chair. It's the main chair or one of the main chairs at ESPN. So I want to get a little bit into preparation. Can you give me, and you can go as long as you want on this, what has been your preparation for this year's draft, and did the preparation at all change knowing now that you have one of the plum assignments? You know, there's only a few chairs that exist in the world. They're on the NFL Network and ESPN, and that's it. And now you have one of these plum chairs. So what has been your preparation for what is a very big assignment on television?
You know, what's interesting is that because of what my background is, because of working in scouting, starting off as a low-level scout all the way back in 2001, up to the time where I was a director and interviewed for the GM job in Philadelphia back in 2010 or whatever it was. Preparation for the draft, preparation for free agency, preparation for the Senior Bowl, and that's kind of working backwards, but that's kind of how the off season goes. Is this something natural to me? This is not doing this now for TV really doesn't change how I approach it, because this is something I've been doing for the past 15 years. So it's just now, it's just that at the end I get to talk about it on a TV set and really be able to now tell everybody who's tuning in the kind of things that I used to just talk about in draft rooms and talk about tucked away in dark little offices where we were talking about which players we liked, what players fit in certain schemes, why we would like this player over that player, why this player's character was more of a concern player. Now I just have a bigger audience instead of just having my buddies who I'm working with in scouting or the coaches I'm working with at certain teams. That's the only thing that's different for me. The work ethic, the preparation, the protocols that I've gone through, the calendar that I use to get ready, it's all the same. The film that I watch, it's all the same. The note-taking is all the same. The slotting of players as far as rounds and where I would take them if I was a GM is all the same. All that stuff is the same. It's just that now it's just the way the information is disseminated and the medium I use, it's just different. That's the only thing that's different for me. Like last year, when I got called upon to go on TV, I mean, I had 2 days notice that I was going to be on TV. And Seth asked me, are you ready? And I was like, look, man, just tell me where to come. Just tell me when you want me to come out there, where I need to be as far as the meetings are concerned. I'm ready to go. I had already prepared for radio. And even when I got the radio assignment for the first time 2 years ago, people were like, well, do you need anything? Is there anything special? Is this too much for you? And I'm like, I've been doing this my whole post-career life as far as being in draft rooms and scouting players and ranking them and slotting them and organizing all this stuff. I got it. I'm good. I don't mean to sound, you know, flippant about it, but I've got it. This year, because I'm on for 3 days, yeah, last year I really only had to prepare for day one and then days two and three on the radio, and there were certain players I could really zero in on. And this year I'm going to be on all 3 days, but it's really, I mean, I just kind of like, I've had more time to look at more players. I've kind of expanded my concentration a little bit wider this year as far as players that I'm looking at in depth, but the process is still the same. The process is something I've been perfecting and working on for years since starting back in 2000, 2001, when I got into scouting.
Physically, do you do the same things, Do you do the same things to prepare for ESPN as you would for a scout? Like, is there something, like, is there a book that you keep where these are handwritten notes on stuff? I'd be really fascinated by, like, the physical process of what you do.
Oh, sure.
Like, or do you keep it on a computer or a laptop, or what's that process for you in terms of just the scouting?
Yeah, I've kind of transitioned a little bit, Richard. I used to be the old spiral bound notebook guy and write everything down and kind of look at it by position. I would always start with the offensive line and then move to tight ends, wide receivers, quarterbacks, running backs. And then I would shift to my focus to defense. I'd always say defense for last, cause that's my concentration. That's where I played. That's where my heart has always been. So I always save those guys for last when I'm most tired, because that was the position that was most fun for me. And then when I look at defensive line, linebackers, and always say secondary for last. And I'd always do it in a spiral bound notebook and just kind of section it off by position. I've transitioned all that stuff now to iPad. I have this app on iPad called Index Card that really organizes this stuff beautifully. I started using it last year. I had it for radio, and then obviously I just took it on set with me for TV. You'll see I'll have two iPads up there on the desk with me, maybe a small notebook if I want to write some things down, but everything for me is put on iPads now. And I'll have every team, what their draft needs are, maybe some notes about that specific team, who I think they should take. And as we just move through the draft, I'll just tap a note card, and it has a note card on one side and a notebook paper on the other side that I can flip it over on the iPad. And it's just, it's beautiful. I mean, it's about as clean and neat as it can be. And you won't see me up there with a bunch of papers and a bunch of notebooks and pencils and all that stuff. I try to stay very, very streamlined. And quite honestly, I won't even really refer to this stuff very much. I love football. Football is who I am. So a lot of this stuff is just recall for me. I can talk about players for days and wouldn't have to look at any notes. This is what I love to do. But yeah, my process is very streamlined now. Two iPads. Everything is, I mean, I'm sitting here looking at it right now in my office. Everything's all organized. I could go and do the draft right now. If the draft was tonight, I'm ready to roll right now. I'm just fine-tuning stuff right now. So I've been working on this really since about December, January, when I went down to the Senior Bowl and we broadcast from down there. I've been cranking on this stuff since then. I have a million and one contacts in the league, great people who know a lot of things about players that I'll be able to share that I know other people won't be able to talk about. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm fired up. We're going to take it to another level next week.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back after this. The NFL draft is just a couple weeks away, and SI has a new miniseries that takes you much deeper than big boards and the 40-yard dash times. The latest episode features Trayvon Boykin, the quarterback who may have to change positions for his shot to play in the NFL. You can find Draft Season on iTunes, Stitcher, or at si.com/draftseason. All right, back in the studio with our guest, ESPN's Lewis Reddick. Did you, in the midst of your scouting career, and obviously as well as television, and I realize when you're evaluating a player, you know, you're evaluating a million characteristics and a million traits. But did you find over the course of your more than a decade in this and now working for ESPN, was there some kind of trait or something in particular that seemed to always be the best indicator of what somebody might become, whether it's the on-field performance, so you trust your eyes, whether it's character makeup, whether it's speed, whether it's strength, but was there a particular attribute that both as a scout and as a draft television analyst that for you, even though it's never going to be perfect, was your best indicator or is your best indicator?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's obvious height, weight, speed metrics that you look for that are going to give a guy a greater chance to succeed than others. You know, big men beat small men in football. I mean, that's pretty obvious. The bigger and stronger and faster you are, the better. But I think the one thing that I've always relied on as far as being able to distinguish who are going to be the real achievers in the league and who are going to be the pretenders, it's this whole concept of instinct. And it's something I used to try and teach scouts a lot about when I was a director. I have a knack for being able to understand why players do certain things on tape in college and whether or not that will be successful in the NFL, because I've been there. I know I can put myself in the shoes of certain players and almost be looking through their helmet with them. And I can tell if a player is going to be able to adapt and whether you can project whether or not that guy is going to be able to handle the increase in competition, the increase in speed, the increase in physicality at the NFL level. And that's something it's hard to quantify it. It's hard to really, like, you know, give you a certain data point that I would rely on, but I rely a lot on my experiences in being able to project players from college to the NFL. Obviously, like I said, you know, going back to how I answered this question initially, there's certain things that I want. There's certain profiles that I look for by position in terms of height, weight, speed, three cone time at the combine, short shuttles at the combine, vertical jump, broad jump. There's certain benchmarks I like to see players hit. But when you're really getting down to it and you're asking yourself, do I want player A versus player B? That's when I rely on, okay, what was it like for me when I played? What was it like when Bill Belichick and Nick Saban were telling me, this is how you have to do it in order for you to be a guy who's just a backup to being a guy who's a starter? What does it look like? And how do you know it when you see it? And I trust myself. I think I know it when I get with these guys. And I know what's expected of them at the NFL level. And that's why I think I've been pretty good at not only picking guys who are in college and who are going to have success at the NFL, but also picking those guys who aren't and going against the grain when there's some people who want to say, well, this guy has all the height, weight, and speed and athletic ability. He should be a great pro. But there are things that are missing in their game that I believe that based on my experiences allow me to step out and say, I don't think that guy's going to make it. I think that guy's going to struggle because I've seen this before and I trust what I'm seeing. Justin Gilbert's a perfect example, defensive back who the Cleveland Browns drafted in the first round, same year they drafted Johnny Manziel, they drafted Justin eighth overall. The year he came out in the draft, he was so big, fast, great ball skills, had a lot of production down there at Oklahoma State. But there were nuances about his game that just led me to believe he was going to struggle. I'm not even talking about off the field. I'm just talking purely on the field. He was going to struggle. And it was something you couldn't quantify. It's something that you just couldn't put on a spreadsheet somewhere. It was something that based on my experience, I could just tell and I had a feeling about. And I rely on that a lot. And it hasn't let me down. It hasn't let me down very much over the years.
One last one on scouting. And then I want to ask you about sort of what we see a lot in the media, quoting anonymous scouts. I'll be curious to get your take on that. But one last one on scouting, and that's on quarterbacks, which always are the focus of the day one coverage on television, and understandably so. It is the position, the most important position in that league. But, Lewis, have you gotten a sense as to why the drafting of quarterbacks remains such a mystery? So many people end up missing, including, by the way, television analysts. And I'm not trying to knock him because he's going to be on your set. But, you know, I remember a couple of years ago how much John Gruden loved Johnny Manziel. He fell in love with him when he did QB camp. And, you know, whether you think athletically he has it or not, clearly there was a disconnect between him being able to handle the NFL maturation wise and not. So why for the position that turns out to be so the most important position, you can't really win without a terrific quarterback. Why is scouting all over the map on quarterbacks, and why do so many evaluators end up missing so much?
Well, I think it's a couple of different reasons. One, I'll say this, from an analyst perspective, very rarely are analysts able to get the in-depth information on a player's personal character the same way that scouts can. And even though scouts get it too, sometimes they mess it up too, but I'll just talk about it from a TV perspective. When you're talking about quarterback in particular, a lot of the things that determine quarterback success, failure have nothing to do at all with how big he is, how fast he is, or how strong his arm is, or how he looks in a pro day workout. That is just very on the surface, easy scouting that most people who don't have a whole lot of expertise in football can look at and go, well, yeah, that guy can throw the football harder than that guy, so that guy should be better than that guy. It goes way, way deeper than that. And I don't know if analysts a lot of times, and I'm not speaking for John, because look, John knows more football than most people. John's forgotten more football than most people ever know. But when you're talking about quarterback, there is a certain level of commitment and a certain personal character profile that you have to have in order to succeed in the NFL. You just do. And Johnny doesn't have it. But no one wanted to talk about that, and no one was talking about that the year he came out, because everyone was just so enamored with how exciting he was and how many big plays he made and how he had transformed Texas A&M football, and they were missing all the stuff underneath that really mattered. And they weren't paying attention to all the stuff that really, really mattered. And when you do that, you're setting yourself up for failure at any position, but in particular at quarterback, where the kind of demands that are put on your time, the demands that are put on you from an organizational perspective, the demands that are put on you from a citywide perspective, a fan base perspective, require you to be, I mean, like assassin serious as far as how you conduct yourself on the field and off the field. We all know Johnny ain't that guy.
Right.
He's not that guy. He's not wired in or built for that kind of responsibility. The NFL isn't Texas A&M. This isn't College Station. This isn't rah-rah foot. This is not college football, man. And he is not built for it mentally and let alone physically. So when you get caught up in all that hype and you get caught up in all the pageantry of college football, and believe me, I love it. I love the Heisman Trophy ceremony. I love bowls. I love it all about college football, but that isn't the NFL. And people get, you know, when you, the further you get away from the college football season, and then you're not playing any football, but you're just, and you're evaluating players in a dark room and you're just kind of leading up to the draft. If you don't think about where this guy came from and what he's going to be asked to do once he gets to the NFL, and you kind of just in that little cocoon called the offseason where you're just watching tape, your projection gets all screwed up. And that's just not analysts. That happens to scouts too. Because right now, if you listen to all the draft stuff, you don't hear anybody talking about, you really don't hear anybody talking about how a player looked on tape back in September, October, November, or what he's going to be asked to do in the NFL. All you hear about now is how strong is his arm? What was his vertical jump? What was his 40? All this stuff that doesn't mean, it means something, but it doesn't really mean anything, anything real important. So when it comes to quarterback, you really have to be dialed in on what the makeup of this player has to be in conjunction with what his physical characteristics have to be. And then here's the kicker. Any player that fails in the NFL, everyone talks about, well, that's just the bust rate in the NFL. 50-50. Some guys make it, some guys don't. As if it's always just the player's fault. Some guys are wired for it and some guys aren't. The NFL is so cocky and arrogant to think that, you know, they always think that they have all the answers. People in the NFL always think they have all the answers, and it's never them. It's never their fault. They never did anything wrong. Hell, if I'm coaching in the NFL, I must be one of the best in the world. Newsflash, they're not. Not every team is built equally. Not every team has the most competent people. I can tell you this. In 1992, I played for the Atlanta Falcons. When I went from the Atlanta Falcons to the Cleveland Browns in 1993, I realized just how different it is in the NFL from one coaching staff and one program to another. Because that was like going from kindergarten to going to getting PhD level coaching. That's what it was like. That's how different it was. And it still exists that way in the NFL. So depending upon where certain guys go, they have no shot versus they have every shot in the world to become, to reach their full potential. So when you see players bust versus players who have success, a lot of times don't just blame it on the player. Trust me, some of these guys are getting coached by guys who don't belong coaching Pop Warner football, let alone coaching NFL football. Some coaching in the NFL is a flat out joke. And some of it is deserving of what we all think it is in terms of the accolades that we give them. You go get coached in New England, I promise you, you're getting PhD level coaching. You go get coached at some of these other places, I couldn't tell you what kind of coaching you're getting. If Tom Brady doesn't go to New England, if Ben Roethlisberger doesn't get drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers and he gets drafted by some of the old coaching staff at the Cincinnati Bengals, Ben Roethlisberger may not be in the league anymore. Tom Brady may not be in the league anymore. A lot of that has to, and so what you'll hear me talk about this on the draft. Carson Wentz, Jared Goff, I can tell you this. If they don't make it, people will say, well, Carson Wentz came from North Dakota State. You guys had him up there way too high. Jared Goff came from Cal, played in the spread offense, way overhyped. If those two kids don't make it, we better go with a fine-tooth comb through the organizations that they went to respectively and start dissecting them. Because organizations ruin players and ruin quarterbacks in particular as much as players ruin themselves. I can promise you that.
That's really interesting. You could do a whole podcast on that alone. Maybe one day I'll bring you back. I want to...
Anytime.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to ask you, one of my colleagues, Peter Bukowski, when I put out on Twitter that you were going to be on today, I got a lot of questions for you from people. But he sent me a note, internal note here, and I thought this was really, really interesting. So I wanted to ask you about it. He wanted to get your perception of the anonymous scout phenomenon that happens in NFL media today, and how, if ever, it was addressed internally by teams. Meaning that in your experience, did teams want to sort of put some stuff out there via an anonymous scout into the media for whatever reason? Was misinformation encouraged? And then as a general thought, how do you view that, Lewis, when you see that? Because, I mean, in Sports Illustrated, it certainly does this too. The month before the draft, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of stories quoting anonymous scouts in the NFL about potential draft picks. It essentially happens every day at this point.
Yeah, some teams think they're being slick and want to put information out there to try and get a player to fall to them, or they're trying to get a team to believe that they want to take a certain player so another player is left behind for them. Some teams play those games. Sure, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of smoke screens being thrown out there right now. And some of it's being done by the GMs themselves. Some of it's being done by personnel directors. Some of it may be being done by low-level scouts who just are easy to get at, have developed relationships with some people in the media, and are easy to get them to, you know, get them to talk. Quite honestly, how do I feel about it? I can tell you this, in my time in the NFL and working in scouting, I never once talked to a single person about a player in the NFL. I think it's I'm not naive enough to say that it doesn't happen, and I get why it happens. I get why GMs talk to certain people like us in the league. I get it. I understand how the business works. But one thing I will say is this. You better be careful as a media person of who you're talking to as far as getting opinions on certain guys and then making those opinions your own and then having you, you know, and then you go on TV or radio or whatever article you're writing and spouting off some of these opinions, because some of these guys who are scouts in the NFL, and I don't mean to sound like crusty and all knowing here, but there's a lot of scouts too in the NFL now who don't know if a football is round or oval or what kind of shape it is. And I wouldn't be trusting their opinions very much at all. So when I see those things, and when I see anonymous scouts talking about this and this player is ahead of that player and this player has shady character as opposed to that player, I just kind of laugh. But I get it. I get the game. I get how things work. I get how people are trying to get information. I would just say this. As a media person, be very careful of who you're talking to, because there's a lot of people that in the NFL who talk about the game and who you're getting information from that I wouldn't trust their information as far as I could punt them. That's what I would say. And to the scouts who are out there talking, look, if you're not one of the people who are really making the decisions, and again, I mean, I want to keep emphasizing this. I understand why certain people in decision-making positions talk to people in the media. It's a relationship that's existed for a long time. If you're not one of those people, you'd be best served to keep your mouth shut. Don't play that game and let the people who are making the decisions decide what they want to tell people and what they don't.
All right. I want to finish up on this topic, Lewis. And that is if in the event that you ever get back into the NFL in management capacity, whether it's general manager, high ranking person at an NFL team, what has your media experience taught you about the media? And then the second part of that would be, would you now deal with the media differently having worked day to day for a media company?
Yeah. What has it taught me? There's a lot of knowledgeable people in the media that work very hard, that are very credible, that are very honest, that really do want to learn the game. They have a job to do. They do rely on people in front offices to help them out with that. I think I have a lot more respect for certain people in the media than I ever did before I met them. And they are not just people who are, you know, just trying to pump you for information like parasites and that they don't really care about you. There's some, look, I've developed some great, great, great relationships being on this side and people who I highly, highly respect. And that leading into the next part of your question, that if I ever went back, I would very much so be willing to kind of help them do their job to a certain degree where it doesn't compromise my ability to do mine and safeguard information that needs to be safeguarded, but also help them do their job, because it's kind of a, you know, the NFL needs the media. The media needs the NFL. The GMs need the media. The media needs GMs. They need decision makers to kind of help them out and kind of help them formulate some of the stories and some of the things that they need to do from a professional perspective. I have much greater respect for that now. Whereas before, quite honestly, I used to feel as though media people were just people who were just trying to pump you for information, didn't really care about you, care about your job, care about putting your job in jeopardy, care about you, you know, making you unable to do your job less effective. I didn't think people really cared. Mm. And I looked at media people with a very, very skeptical eye before, very skeptical. And now I have a much greater appreciation for how hard many of the people in this business work.
Do you?
I think that'd be something that would benefit me and them if I ever went back, for sure.
And I mean, to interrupt you, but I do want to ask you, because it sort of leads to an interesting question. You were, again, you worked for the Eagles and personnel, the Redskins, two teams, and obviously you had people around the league that you knew, or worked with. As a general rule, do you think NFL executives and officials inside those buildings, do they see the media as the enemy, a necessary evil, or something else? And I'm not trying to stereotype everyone, but the relationship between NFL coaches and officials with the local media is fascinating. It's probably different in every market, but, you know, there is, because of how the league structure is set up, you do wonder if inside those meeting rooms, and you were in many of them for many years, you know, is the media just thought of as like a necessary enemy or something like that?
Yeah, I think in many places, in many situations, it's thought of as a necessary evil, something that you have to do, something that you kind of, I think people look at as, look, they're trying to do their job. They're trying to get us to help them. Well, we can use them to help us. And it's one of those where it stays pretty professional like that. And everyone kind of tries to do that dance, so to speak. So you're giving them what they want. They're giving you what they want, what you want. And you kind of like move on and then go on about your business. I do think it can go further than that. I think it can be something where it becomes personal, where it becomes something where it's very respectful, where you can become close friends with people and still respect those boundaries where, look, you don't want to put them in any kind of compromising positions and they shouldn't put you in any. And I think because of me being on this side of it right now, that if I did go back, look, there's certain guys who I work with at ESPN who I consider dear friends. And I would help out as much as I possibly could to help them do their job without overstepping any boundaries and compromising my ability to do mine. And they would understand that. And I think that's, I'm good with that. I'm good with that. And I think there are coaches and GMs in the league who have very good personal relationships with certain members of the media and do tell them things that they don't tell everybody in the media. I think it's a case by case basis. And I do think there's also people who really don't want to get close to the media at all and just look at it as a necessary evil. But I don't think it has to be that way. I think it can become personal. It can become something where it's a significant relationship. And I'll tell you this, if I go back, the significant relationships that I have right now with certain people will remain. And you will probably be able to figure out who those people are, because they will know more stuff about me than others will. And I'm good with that.
Last one for me, Lewis. Who is someone at ESPN who we as viewers do not see on camera, but has been invaluable to what you do on air. Who's someone behind the scenes that you want to give a little bit of love to, who the public would never know this, but this is a person who really helps make what you do and the coverage that you are part of really go?
Wow. There's so many of them. The people who really, really work hard and really do a lot of things behind the scenes to help things go. But I would say this. I would say during my time up there at ESPN, the person who, right from the get-go, really put their arm around me and led me to believe that I could really do big, big things in this business is the guy who I referenced at the beginning of this, and that's Jerry Mattelon. Right from the get-go, Richard, this guy said, you can be special in this. You can kind of blaze new trails as far as this profession is concerned. I don't think they've ever seen anything like you. And you're a guy who's coming from nowhere. And you're not the guy with the gold jacket, the Pro Bowls and all that stuff, but I still think you can kind of blow the doors off of this business. And he coached me on all the little nuances, was brutally honest, told me when I was frowning too much, told me when I was talking too much, told me when I was hogging the shit. And he, I think, has had that kind of influence on many people behind the scenes. Many, many people who would tell you the same thing, that he made people believe that they were better than even they thought they could be. And I think that's vital in this business. It's vital. Confidence goes a long way towards making someone either good or going from good to great in this business. And he's a guy who I'd probably give a lot of credit to and would want to shine a light on for me.
That's impressive that you say that, Lewis. The audience is going to know this, but I'll say it again. These are my words, not Lewis's, but Jerry Mattelon was let go from ESPN after many, many years. So I give Lewis Riddick a lot of props because he just praised the guy who his boss has made a decision, in my opinion, foolishly, to let go. But that is a guy who helped talent for years and years and years and years get really, really good on television. Lewis Riddick, it will be on the ESPN's NFL draft coverage for all 3 days. If you've read my column, you know that I was ahead of the curve there, and I think that's going to be fantastic, and I think this Lewis will be doing this for a long time. He's really one of the people I think you should listen to when it comes to NFL evaluation. He deals straight, in my opinion, with viewers. He does the prep, which I really respect, and I think he's an authority on the sport, which is ultimately what you want as a viewer. Lewis, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I had saved it because I wanted to do it around the draft, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Absolutely. Been looking forward to this as well. Thank you for having me, Richard.
You got it. Thanks, Lewis. All right, back in the studio with Alan Kim. Alan, man, we could have probably done 2 hours with Lewis Riddick. That was really interesting. I am fascinated by the dynamic of how scouts and NFL personnel people think of media, what's going on in the rooms and how much are, and we could, you know, you didn't even really get that much into it, but how much media do they read? Do they send misinformation out there? Are there certain people in the league they talk to, which is probably true? And then again, this guy is just really interesting because I think he's clearly confident, but the confidence comes from like a place of like intellect and preparation. And I don't really want to come off like I'm kissing his ass that much, but like the NFL media needs more people on TV like this guy and less people like famous athlete X who sort of is just showing up and not doing prep.
No, absolutely. I mean, he's one of the best things about ESPN's draft coverage moving forward. He was great last year. I typically watch NFL Network, or I kind of swap in between.
Right.
But he's a reason to continue to watch like ESPN's draft coverage.
I agree. I mean, I think, I've said this many times. I'm not the biggest fan of ESPN's day one coverage. People know my issues with Berman and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But Lewis Riddick now makes me seriously want to watch ESPN.
Yeah.
And I love Mayock, and I think he's great. I think he's the best singular draft analyst. But like that guy's opinions come from a place of knowledge and research and preparation, and he is interesting to me. And I'm like you. I think I will find myself flipping more to ESPN day one, singularly because of him.
Yeah, totally. And like he was a huge surprise last year.
Definitely.
And he had very little to no prep which is incredible.
But he said on this podcast clearly because he was working on radio, like it was osmosis at that point. He had prepped. The index card stuff was really interesting. Yeah. That'd actually be really cool to just sort of see what his iPad looks like on set.
Yeah.
Because he clearly is sort of dialed in there. All right. Well, our thanks to Louis Riddick. That was a really, I thought that was a really interesting conversation. I know people always say to me, you think every conversation is interesting. It's probably true. But in this case, it really was particularly interesting. My thanks to previous guests, Ken Burns, Jeff Passan, Joe Drape, those two authors and writers on how to write a book. Hubie Brown, Zach Lowe, Renee Young. Those have been like the last five or so. They were all awesome for different reasons. I could listen to this. I'm sure Alan Kim Can is a big NBA fan. To Hubie Brown all day. We'll have to bring him back one day if he wants to come. And the next couple podcasts will include Jessica Mendoza of ESPN, the MLB analyst. All right. So let me thank my producer, Alan Kim, my producer, Bette Marston, Dan Bloom of Panoply, Ryan Hunt, Paul Fichtenbaum, John Wertheim, and Chris Stone for their support. You can basically get past episodes on if you follow us on iTunes, Stitcher, or at si.com/podcast. You can follow Alan Kim and I on Twitter if you guys have any questions for us. So, really appreciate your support, and we'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.